This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. Maybe you're the kind of person who doesn't want to know what happens to your food once you've swallowed as it makes its way down the digestive tract until it comes out the other end. But if you want to know, my first guest, Mary Roach, has just written the book for you. She says to her readers, I don't want you to say, this is gross. I want you to say, I thought this would be gross, but it's really interesting. Okay, and maybe a little gross. Her book is called Gulp. She's known for her humorous books about science, including Stiff, The Curious Lives of Human Cadavers, Spook, Science Tackles the Afterlife, Bonk, The Curious Coupling of Sex and Science, and Packing for Mars, The Curious Science of Life in the Void. Mary Roach, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
So let's talk about saliva. I mean, if you didn't have saliva, you'd have a dry mouth. It would be hard to eat. It would be hard to talk. Your tongue would stick to your palate. It would be bad for your teeth. But we have this kind of dual relationship with saliva. You know, in our mouths, it's very helpful. But once you spit it out, it's considered really quite disgusting. And even if you can tolerate your own saliva, anybody else's saliva is going to be perceived as quite disgusting. And one of the biggest insults you can give in a casual way is to spit, to spit at them. So what does saliva do for us? For example, people think of saliva as spreading germs, but also saliva has a kind of neutralizing germ effect in your own mouth. So can you talk about that dichotomy?
Yes, saliva. And this was all news to me. I went over to the Netherlands and I visited this woman, this beautiful Italian woman, Erica Saletti, who's devoted her career to the study of saliva, this most repellent of substances. And I learned a lot of things that day. I had no idea. I mean, I, like anyone else, find saliva fairly repugnant once it's outside my own mouth. But she did this amazing demonstration where she took a medicine dropper and she took some vinegar, and she could have used wine or anything acid, orange juice. She could have used really anything in that low pH acid zone. And she dropped a couple drops of vinegar on my tongue and said, pay attention. And immediately this flush of what felt like tepid water came into my mouth. And that was my body sensing that there was this acid in the mouth, which can break down tooth enamel, and rushing in like the cavalry to dilute that acid and bring the pH to a safe level. And it happens right. I mean, I would love, people need to do this. They need to take a gulp of wine, even soda. Soda is acid as well, and pay attention. And there's this gush of fluid. And I'm 54 years old, and I never noticed this. So I went around for days, you know, taking sips of wine going, oh, there it is. There's the saliva coming in. And that's critical. If you don't have that, your enamel softens. It just begins to, your teeth dissolve. So if you have a condition where you don't generate enough saliva, it's not just icky and dry mouth. It's your teeth are in danger. Honestly, someone should bottle the stuff. It's fairly miraculous, and we haven't even gotten into the antiviral and the antibacterial elements of it.
Go there.
Yeah, okay. It renders viruses non-infective. You think of kissing someone as a way of getting a cold or flu, but it's not a good way. If you want to transfer the cold or flu, it's mostly you're touching something, then you touch your nose or your eye, and that way makes its way into where it can infect you. But also there's in saliva, there's these histatins which help wounds heal. So when someone kisses a baby's boo-boo, like a scrape, or when a pet licks its wounds, it's actually, because you think, it's full of bacteria, don't do that. But there's these healing elements. Saliva was a home remedy for cuts and scrapes and chancres and things. People would apply the spittle of a, first thing in the morning, spittle of an old man or something. It would be like the remedy. But there's some medical sense to it.
I thought that saliva of some animals, like cats, would help them, you know, cleanse or heal themselves, but not true for humans.
I did too. I found a study on human bites and the rate of infection after somebody's been bitten by a human. And sometimes this is in the form of somebody punching someone and their mouth passively opening a wound on their hand. There are quite a few cases of that. And the rate, I don't have the statistic in my head, but it was very low. It was like 2 in 52 or something. It was very low rate of infection. And again, counterintuitive. You assume that the mouth is this sort of cesspool of bacteria. And while there is bacteria in there, anytime you put food in your mouth or you stick your finger in your mouth, you're introducing bacteria into a warm, moist place. And they're initially those bacteria are going, yee-haw. But then saliva's got an anti-clumping element so that colonies don't tend to build up on teeth the way they might otherwise. So it's a pretty miraculous substance, and it doesn't get any respect at all.
So let's talk about taste. You write about how taste is really largely smell. So why is taste so dependent on our noses?
Well, there's taste, which is on the tongue, and that's just the basic building blocks. That's salt, sweet, bitter, sour, and umami, which umami is kind of a brothy, kind of a latecomer. I don't know who let umami in. But anyway, it's those five basics. And everything else, chocolate, vanilla, lemon, cherry, wood smoke, all of these fabulous things that you pick up when you taste wine, all of that is happening in the nose. It's the upper reaches of the nasal cavity, the olfactory epithelium, all these volatile gases. When you hold wine in your mouth or chocolate and it begins to melt, it releases all of these gases that head up into the top of the nasal cavity, and you read them as flavor, but really they are smell-based. About 80 to 90% of what we call flavor is olfactory.
Let's swallow. So
okay.
we've tasted the food, good, we've chewed it, we swallow it. What happens next?
In the stomach is it, I had always thought that the main function of the stomach and its acids and enzymes was to break down the food. And while it does do that, the other thing it's doing is killing bacteria. Gastric acid is it's another one of the body's defenses against bacteria that you've taken in. The whole alimentary canal, this, you know, from mouth to the other end, that's a zone where bacteria are coming in. So the body has all these defense mechanisms, and gastric acid is one of those. It's very effective. It doesn't kill 100% of the, there are bacteria that can survive, but a whole lot of them get killed right in there in the stomach. But the stomach's also, it's reducing what you eat to this material, kind of a slurry called chyme, C-H-Y-M-E. And that is then, when it's of the proper consistency, spurted along to the small intestine, where those wonderful fingers, the villi, absorb whatever nutrients they can.
So we're eating, we're following the food down the digestive system. How does our body tell us, you've eaten enough, you can stop now?
The human stomach, goes to great lengths not to burst, because the stomach resides inside a creature that really, really loves to eat and frequently overeat. So it needs to be able to take emergency measures if its owner is eating to excess. And one of the simplest things your stomach can do to relieve pressure is something called the transient lower esophageal sphincter relaxation, which means burp. That's what that is. That's a burp. But that's the medical term. So just ditching the gas, whatever, if you got gas building up, that's causing pressure. And if you've eaten something fermenty, or you've eaten bicarbonate of soda to make yourself feel better and you took too much, sometimes the gas can build up very quickly, so quickly that it outpaces the body's ability to react. And in the very, very, very rare cases of stomach rupture, it's frequently bicarbonate of soda that's been the culprit, not the food itself.
What does the bicarbonate do?
It produces gas. It hits the stomach and there's a reaction, chemical reaction happens, and it produces gas. And the idea is you want to be able to burp, and it makes you burp and you feel better, because burping is a release of gas. So you, a little bit is good, a lot, not so good. But the next thing that your body does if you persist in overeating is it's a regurgitation reflex. You would throw up. And I interviewed professional competitive eaters about this, and I said, well, how do you deal? This is an automatic reflex that happens. If you stretch the stomach beyond a certain point, you'll throw up. And how do you guys not throw up? And he said, well, we do, but the rules are it can come up, it just can't come out. So you swallow it back down. And that was probably the most revolting thing I learned in the entire book.
I can't
and
comprehend
now I've shared
competitive
it with
eating.
Millions Yeah. Americans.
If you're a competitive eater, do you stretch your stomach so it can accommodate more food? Like, do you gradually stretch it like you were exercising your stomach or something?
Well, there was a gastroenterologist who brought a competitive eater into the hospital where he worked and took a look at what was going on, set him up in front of a fluoroscope, and gave him hot dogs with a kind of a side of barium so they'd show up. And he watched as the competitive eater and the not and an ordinary person ate hot dogs. The competitive eater was able to eat this prodigious amount of hot dogs, and he doesn't have a larger stomach. Their stomachs are no larger, but they're what's called compliant. They're able to stretch and accommodate more food. So they start, very often these are people with highly compliant stomachs. They're kind of like lions, you know, it's a feast or famine type of animal that has a huge capacity to take it in and then live off it for a week. So they've got these compliant stomachs, but then on top of that, they're training themselves. And so they do both. They have a genetic advantage and then they're practicing. And it's largely mental, I'm told, that you're getting used to a really unpleasant, bloated feeling and forcing yourself to keep going.
What an odd sport. At this point, I think I ought to say, like, this isn't going to be the most appetizing part of the conversation. If you're eating, you know, a meal now or a snack, I know you might find part of this conversation a little off-putting. At the same time, think of it this way. When you're done eating that snack or that meal, what's happening in your body is going to be exactly what we're about to talk about. So... So let's talk deeper into digestion. And one of the most embarrassing things about the digestive process is digestive gas when it is accidentally released. What is digestive gas and why does it smell so bad?
The technical term is flatus. Flatulence is the condition of having flatus. Flatus is mostly hydrogen. In about a third of the population, it's also methane, and both of those are odorless. The odor is provided by mostly sulfur compounds, like hydrogen sulfide is the main culprit in what is the technical term here again, noxious flatus. So it's your sulfur compounds. The foods that you want to avoid if you're troubled by noxious flatus would be any of the sulfur-containing cruciferous vegetables like broccoli, cabbage, kale. Those are notorious. Protein, red meat. Red meat is also makes for smellier, more noxious flatus.
You know, you write that the amount of intestinal gas in your system peaks 5 hours after a meal. Can you explain why?
Yes, because it's formed in the colon, which is the last stop before the rectum. That's where the food that your body couldn't absorb, the stuff that it couldn't absorb and use, kind of the waste material, insoluble fibers and, you know, chunks of corn or whatever, you know, the woody stuff, it gets all get passed into the colon. And there are bacteria in there that can make use of that. It's food for your bacteria, in essence. And when bacteria break this material down, they produce gas. So in essence, your gas is the bacteria's gas. It's bacteria farts, the buildup. And at a certain point, your body makes the decision to expel it. And if it's because it gets painful after a while, if you have a tremendous amount of gas, and often older people have a flabbier colon and it stretches more. And the only way you feel pain in the colon is from stretching. The stretch receptors read their activation as pain. So you get that gas pain and you want to get rid of it. And that's your passage of flatus.
As we make our way down the digestive system, again, I want to say to our listeners, this is subject matter you might find very unappetizing. My apologies if you're eating at the moment. But again, I just want to mention this is what's going to happen in your system after you're done eating. So let's go down toward the end of the digestive process. And I learned from your book that something that should have been obvious, though I can't say I'd ever thought about it at all, is that the rectum has a lot of nerve endings in it because?
Well, the anus specifically is the champion here. The human anus is this ring of muscle, and it's highly innervated. It's got tons of nerves. And the reason is that it needs to be able to discriminate by feel between solid, liquid, and gas, and be able to selectively release one or maybe all of those. And thank heavens for the anus, because you really... A nod of gratitude, ladies and gentlemen, to the human anus. It's kind of an amazing thing that it does. It's very impressive.
So one of the odder things that you learn for your book is about hooping. And this relates to stashing things in your body so it will go undetected. say a little bit more about like what hooping is and what are some of the things you learned have been stored at the bottom end of the digestive tract?
Well, this is the rectum chapter, and I wanted to provide a narrative that would be appropriate and an interesting setting for the reader. And I thought, well, what is the rectum? Well, it's a storage facility. The rectum enables us to hold on to waste, and that means we don't need to stop what we're doing and find a bathroom. We can hold it. We have a little closet there, a little suitcase, if you will, and we can hold it there. And that, you know, it's a force for civilized behavior. And again, thank you to the rectum as well. Okay, so I thought, all right, well, who would be someone I would be interesting to talk to? And people who smuggle contraband. For people who smuggle contraband, the human body, the human alimentary system is a handy pocket, if you will, particularly the rectum. In prisons, I was at Avenal State Prison where they have a problem with cell phone smuggling, people smuggling cell phones in and conducting drug deals and hits and things like that they shouldn't be doing. And so I spent some time with a man who is it's called hooping, as in through the hoop. And hooping is a way of life in prison. It's not, because I thought, well, this would be a little strange to sit down with a man and talk about the things that he puts in his rectum. But in fact, he was just like, yeah, well, what do you want to know? So it was an interesting afternoon.
So what are some of the things that he's put there?
The most common thing is bindles of tobacco, because you're not supposed to have tobacco. And so people put these plugs of tobacco wrapped in a condom or a piece of latex. And that's often, he said, if you're going into solitary confinement, you're going into the hole, the other hole, you want to bring in your smoking material. So they'll put up the tobacco and the lighter. And so they'll smuggle it into solitary because you're not allowed to have it there. And this shed light on something I'd come upon when I was writing Bonk, which was a collection of things that people had put in rectums. They, showed up in the emergency room. And here was this one that just made no sense to me at the time. It was magazine, tobacco pouch, and spectacles. And I thought, who puts that up their rectum? And now I realize this was probably a guy going into solitary, and he wears his reading material and his smoking material and his glasses.
Mary Roche, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much, and happy digesting.
Same to you, Terry. Thank you so much for having me on.
Mary Roche is the author of Gulp, Adventures on the Alimentary Canal. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. This weekend, AMC presents the 2-hour season premiere of Season 6 of Mad Men. Our TV critic, David Bianculli, promises not to give away any key details, but he does have some things to say about the return of what he calls one of television's very best series, and about today's TV dramas in general.
For decades, when broadcast television called the shots and dominated the TV landscape, the biggest event of the year was the fall season, when networks would unveil their new shows and return with fresh episodes of old favorites. But now, because of cable and satellite TV, the fall season isn't the only game in town. There's the summer season, which used to be nothing but reruns. Now it's the time when HBO brings back True Blood, and when AMC, in just a few months, is going to present the final episodes of Breaking Bad. There's the winter season, when we get new episodes of Justified, Girls, and House of Lies, and just finished a batch of exciting new Walking Dead episodes. And now we come to the spring TV season, which, as in nature, is a time to rejoice in the spirit of rebirth. Game of Thrones is back with its strongest season yet, and so is Doctor Who. And best of all, there's AMC's Mad Men, delivering all the pleasures that today's most ambitious drama series can bring. Way, way back in the 1970s, NBC used to present a rotating series called Novels for Television, and all the networks then were big on miniseries adaptations of popular novels. These days, the best weekly drama series are the novels for television. As with the classic soap opera form, loyal audience members get to know these characters so intimately that subtleties of plot and personality carry echoes not only of recent episodes, but from earlier seasons. Matthew Weiner, creator of Mad Men, has established his own narrative rules for his Emmy-winning drama series, the continuing story of advertising executive Don Draper in the 1960s. On Mad Men, the breaks between seasons sometimes take longer than a year, and when the show returns, it doesn't pick up where it left off. It leaves a gap, And viewers have to start each season as though they're the ones who left and have to catch up. What year is it? What's the status of Dawn's marriage? And what's going on with all the other people in and around Dawn's life? Those are the very basic questions that, as each season begins, Mad Men is eager to protect. And I'll honor that, so you can tune in Sunday and figure it out for yourself. But my favorite moment from the 2-hour season premiere is one that reveals something only about Dawn, played so sparingly and perfectly by John Hamm. It's in a setting so familiar that it could be any year at any time. Dawn, with his fellow advertising team, is pitching a new ad campaign to his clients. Those who have kept up with Mad Men know that this is the place where Don Draper thrives and shines, where he can come up with just the shimmery language and images necessary to seduce his clients like a snake charmer into seeing and raving about his vision. This time, the clients own a luxury hotel in Hawaii, and Don has come up with an ad campaign that doesn't show the hotel at all, just a set of footprints in the sand leading into the water and vanishing. Don spins his magic while the clients react, and Don's colleagues, Smarmy Pete and Loose Cannon Roger, chime in. But this time, for the first time, Don's verbal seduction doesn't have the desired result.
I think we're not selling a geographical location. We're selling an experience. It's not just a different place. You are different. And you'd think there'd be an unsettling feeling about something so drastically different, but there's something else. You don't miss anything. You're not homesick. It puts you in this state. The air and the water are all the same temperature as your body. It's sensory, the music, the fragrance, the breeze and the blue. Stan?
It's just a sketch.
Hawaiian legend has it that the soul can go in and out of the body, but that it usually leaves from a leeward point into the waves. Hawaii, the jumping off point.
So, what happened to him?
He got off the plane, took a deep breath, shed his skin, and jumped off.
I assume this is a photograph.
What color?
That water is transparent. Well, I suppose it reminds me a little of the cinema. But mostly, I see James Mason at the end of that movie walking into the sea.
What is that movie?
I'm not sure I know what you're talking about.
He's killing himself. I don't think they show it, but he's going to swim out until he can't swim back.
That may be a personal association for you, but that's not what this means.
We looked at this. None of us thought of that.
A Star is Born.
The copy is all about the Hawaiian legend. Aloha means hello and goodbye.
I'm sorry, but this is very poetic.
Thank you.
Where's our hotel? Where's the Pink Palace? And Diamond Head. You gotta have Diamond Head in the shot.
Anyone can do that.
I don't agree.
I'm guessing, and this is only a guess, that this will end up being the primary theme of this new season on Mad Men. It'll be Don Draper losing his touch as the 60s march on. It'll be Don Draper doing in the show what his drawn caricature does in the beginning of every episode as the opening credits play. He goes into freefall, surrounded by all the images of happiness and desire he helped create.
David Bianculli is founder and editor of the website TV Worth Watching and teaches TV and film history at Rowan University in New Jersey. The national debate over marriage equality has gotten our linguist, Jeff Nunberg, thinking about the changing uses of the word marriage.
It's a funny thing about dictionaries. First, we're taught to revere them. Then we have to learn to set them aside. Nobody ever went wrong starting a middle school composition with "according to Webster's." But that's not a phrase you'd use at the beginning of an op-ed commentary about terrorism or racism. When it comes to the words that do the cultural heavy lifting, we're not about to defer to some lexicographer hunched over a dusty keyboard. Except, of course, if the word is marriage. Now that even a lot of Republicans are accepting civil unions as a fallback position, What opponents of same-sex marriage object to most strenuously seems to be just its name. As a tactical move, thumping the dictionary has replaced thumping the Bible. As Rush Limbaugh recently put it, by definition, same-sex people cannot be married. You had the feeling that that by definition was really just a stand-in for by God. So lexicographers know they're on the hot seat as they confront the changing uses of the word. When Merriam-Webster revised their definition a couple of years ago, they went with what I think of as a two-state solution. They kept an older definition for marriage as the state of being united to a person of the opposite sex. But they added a second definition as the state of being united to a person of the same sex in a relationship like that of traditional marriage. Not surprisingly, that triggered headlines like Webster's redefines marriage on conservative websites. Merriam said they had no political agenda, they were just describing the language as it was actually being used. But the definition is a train wreck, which is what's apt to happen when you try to move forward while you're looking over both shoulders at the same time. That second meaning doesn't describe the way anybody uses the word. Gays and lesbians aren't claiming the right to a recognized relationship like traditional marriage, as Merriam puts it. They're talking about marriage without an asterisk, which is one reason why public opinion has shifted so rapidly in their favor. And the cultural right isn't about to sanction any use of the M-word for same-sex couples. The one thing both sides agree on is that whatever definition you give to marriage, there had better be just one of them. That's how the most recent edition of the Encarta Dictionary deals with a word, with a single definition that eliminates any reference to gender, a legally recognized relationship between two people who intend to live together as sexual and domestic partners. That's a redefinition of marriage, all right. But redefining a word isn't always the same as giving it a new meaning. Sometimes you're just trying to pare it down to the core concept that people miss the first time around. Dictionary definitions of camera used to mention film and plates. Now they just refer to a photosensitive surface. But the meaning of camera isn't different. It's just that now technology lets us see what its essence has been all along. Changes in social attitudes can prompt those reevaluations too. Until just a couple of years ago, the Oxford English Dictionary defined the romantic sense of love as a feeling of attachment based upon difference of sex. But the English language has never precluded describing a romantic attachment between two men or two women as love. It's just that those relationships were officially invisible to the OED's Victorian compilers. And other definitions would have led you to conclude that only men could have girlfriends or pay court to someone. In fact, the OED still defines a couple as a man and a woman united by love or marriage. No doubt they'll get around to replacing a man and a woman with two persons, but not because couple has a new meaning, but because we can finally see what was really basic to the old one. You can read Encarta's degendered definition of marriage in the same way, a legally recognized relationship between two people. That does what a good definition should. It crisply describes everything that's in the category and nothing that isn't. And like the redefinition of camera, it extends to the past as well as the present. It's not just what marriage has come to mean, it's all the word has ever meant, even when not everybody had the right to it. It can take people a while to get that. Marriage is more than a label to both sides. Words tend to pick up the flavors of the broth they've been steeping in. They're surrounded by customs and prescriptions that seem to infuse their very meanings. When I hear somebody using a word in a new way, it can sometimes sound more like a usage error than a challenge to my unexamined notions. I had to do a little mental stutter step the first couple of times I heard a gay friend talking about his husband, until I realized, oh yeah, it's just the guy in a marriage, the same as it ever was. But there's never been an age that was so quick or adept at making these adjustments. We spent the 1990s tacking virtual and cyber onto the names of what seemed like new kinds of things. Then we spent the next decade taking the prefixes off again as we realized that the new things were basically the same as the old ones. I have to get some e-money from my virtual bank so I can play cyber poker. That sounds so 1997. How long before gay marriage sounds equally quaint?
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist who teaches at the University of California, Berkeley School of Information. Coming up, Ty Bird talks about the evolution of the Hollywood star and why we care about celebrities. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. Because our next guest, Ty Burr, is a film critic for the Boston Globe, he's met a lot of movie stars and is often asked what they're really like. He says his new book, Gods Like Us, on movie stardom and fame, isn't so much about what movie stars are really like. It's more about why we ask that question in the first place. The book is a history of movie stardom and considers how the creation of stars has changed, how their place in our culture has changed, and how the technology that creates celebrity gradually changed the kinds of stars audiences wanted. Before joining the Boston Globe, Ty Burr wrote about movies for Entertainment Weekly. Ty Burr, welcome to Fresh Air. Since we're talking about movie stardom and modern fame, I want to start by saying your name sounds like the kind of name a movie studio might give to an actor with a name that sounded too ethnic. Like, say, like, Tevye Bernstein might be Ty Burr or something like that. So is that your birth name, Ty Burr?
Oh, you had to ask that. No, I have actually a long first, very waspy first name that actually at one point was a last name because that's what wasps do to torture their children. They give them all last names. I'm not going to share it with you. It's a number of syllables. But I've been called Ty since I was a kid. And you're right, it does sound like something that I might have cooked up in the early 50s and... Not that they would put me out there for beefcake, but, you know, who's the actor I'm thinking of? Not Ty Harden. Is it Ty Harden?
Yeah. Ty Harden, yeah. He was on one of those West, like, Bronco or something.
He was a star who was manufactured and marketed in that time period. And, Tyrone Power. I mean, it's not an uncommon name.
Right. So do you feel a connection with stars who have changed their names or had their names changed for them by the studio?
I do sort of wonder what the identity politics of it is when a studio hands you a new name and says, this is who you are. Roy Scherer, you are now Rock Hudson. Marian Morrison, you are now John Wayne. Lucille LeSueur actually had her new name picked in a fan contest, and Joan Crawford won out. You know, what does that do to you to take on that new name and the new, you know, persona that might go with it?
Well, what do you think that does to you? Because it is one of the questions you're trying to get at in your book.
Right. One of the things that sort of obsessed me and got me to write this book is why we respond to these people who we think are larger than life that are, especially in the classic days, you know, manufactured and all their irregularities sanded off and presented to us as some kind of perfection. And we think that if we can watch them enough, emulate them enough, write fan letters to them enough, we might become like them, or we might get something like they have. And I think part of that goes into the naming of them. Frances Gumm. You know, maybe you're not going to go see a movie starring Frances Gumm, but when MGM renames her Judy Garland, a garland. It's a lovely thing. It's a necklace of flowers. It gilds the lily, as it were, of this new creation, and almost puts the factory stamp on it. And you know, it's interesting to see in later years, especially when you got into the 60s and to today, there's almost a sort of pride in not changing your name. You know, if Mia Wasikowska had worked for MGM in the early 30s, she would not be Mia Wasikowska.
Do you think that this has created a disconnect because we might want to become more like the stars, but the stars might feel like they're not like the person who they've been presented as being either?
Oh, I think that definitely, especially in the factory years, I think there had to have been some confusion on the part of these young stars. Think about it. You know, you're Clark Gable, you're Joan Crawford, you're in your early 20s. You haven't really sort of figured out who you are. And, you know, in Clark Gable's case, he'd sort of been bumming around the country doing acting jobs and physical labor jobs. And then he hits the movies and he's in 12 movies in his first year and everybody's just going crazy over him. And he may not have known really who he was, and he actually befriended, made very good friends with the head of MGM Publicity. His job was to create this person that we thought Clark Gable should be, and he would send him out on photo shoots, hunting and fishing and doing all sorts of manly things, and Clark Gable didn't do those things, but he started picking them up. He started reverse engineering his own personality from the persona that the studios gave him.
Now, you're right about how in the very early days of movies, and I mean very early days when movies were like really short, short little things, there weren't stars. How far back are we going here?
Well, I mean, if you consider that the movies were invented by a bunch of different people in the late 1880s. Stars were not billed by name until about 1910. So you've got about 15 years there where the medium is really taking its first baby steps, but then becoming a commercial medium where people would go to Nickelodeons and sit down and watch, one-reelers or two-reelers, generally, 10-minute or 20-minute films, 10 minutes in the early days. And what you would see when you went to see these movies, you'd get the title of the film, and you'd get the company that made it, Biograph, Edison, Kalem, whatever, and you would not get anything about the people in them.
Why not?
There's a variety of reasons and theories about it. One thing was that movie acting and movie actors were considered low class compared to stage acting. And if you were a stage actor who maybe needed to pick up some extra cash, you didn't really brag about going to work for the movies. The studio heads, the men who ran the early studios, didn't want to make people into stars because they would ask for more money. But I think the more important thing was that in the early days, people really didn't understand what actors did in movies. There needed to be a paradigm shift. When you read early movie reviews or articles about what was going on in these early silent films, the verbs they use are not, they don't talk about acting. They talk about shamming, posing, presenting. There needed to be sort of almost a brain shift here to understand that what these people doing was performative, and in fact a different kind of acting that, because the camera gives every viewer the best seat in the house, brought you closer to the actors. So the studios and the men who ran them did not promote the stars, didn't think they had to, but the audience started getting obsessed with these people because they were closer to them, and the people seemed more life-size and more real than those faraway stage actors. So they started writing letters to the studios and to this, to the Biograph girl. Please tell me your name. What's your name? I'll keep it a secret. You can tell me, and I won't tell anybody else. That was the first big secret in the movies. What's your name?
So who was it? I mean, who was it in the movie industry that decided you had to transform people into movie stars? You had to change their name. You had to dress up their biographies, lie a lot sometimes, in order to really sell these people as stars. Like, where does that begin?
I think of the early movie moguls, the most far-seeing was probably Adolf Zucker, who founded Paramount. He was the guy who recognized that Mary Pickford, who was sort of ping-ponging back and forth between the Broadway stage and one-reelers, that she could be somebody who had something special that he could promote and nuance and mold, and he was willing to pay her money for it, and a lot of money for it. But really the first star factory that we, as we know it, was MGM, which was actually late to the silent era. It was a new studio founded toward the, in the early to mid-1920s. And Louis B. Mayer, the man running it in running the studio in California, he, under his aegis, he created a classic vertical factory system. And one part of that system was the creation of a star machine in which they would hire and contract young actors, change their names, give them lessons in deportment, fix their noses if necessary, occasionally pay them to divorce their spouses. That's what happened with Johnny Weissmuller when he became a sensation in Tarzan. They paid off his wife to get a divorce.
Why?
Because he had such a rabid female following. If you see those early Tarzan movies, here's this Olympic swimmer running around in a very skimpy loincloth. And it was a kind of a powerful fantasy figure, this jungle king who is going to carry you off and do, wonderful, terrible things to you in the jungle. And so his following, Weissmuller's following, was very, very female. And the MGM wanted to, promote him as a single guy, because for him to be married would have, killed the fantasy. So I don't know whether there were issues in the marriage to begin with, but apparently they paid off Mrs. Weissmuller to go away.
Oh, I hope they paid her a lot of money. If you're just joining us, my guest is Ty Burr. He's a film critic for the Boston Globe and author of the new book, Gods Like Us, on movie stardom and modern fame. So in doing research for your book, who were some of the movie stars whose stardom you found especially interesting? And I'm talking about people from the past, from past decades. Interesting because either you thought their stardom was really enduring or because you couldn't quite comprehend what people saw in them.
One of the stars I ended up, to me, he's almost the the ultimate star, ultimate in the terms of that he's been through so many changes in his career, and he's never gone away. He's been up, he's been down, he's been forgotten, he's been lauded as Mickey Rooney. He was making movies by the time he was like three. He had his own film series, silent film series, when he was a little kid, the Mickey Maguire movies. By the mid-30s, he was the most popular actor in America. He was number one on the box office list for about 3 or 4 years in the Andy Hardy movies primarily, and the musicals he made with Judy Garland. And after World War II, he couldn't get arrested. Was totally washed up. And then he keeps coming back and going away, and he wins a Tony, and he wins an Emmy, and he has a religious conversion. I mean, he's almost like a fractal history of American movie stardom in one guy, and he is still here. He's like in his mid-90s, and he's still making movies, and I don't think he will ever die.
Can I say I've never really understood what made Mickey Rooney such a star?
I'll tell you what made Mickey Rooney such a star. He is uncontainable. If you see his early roles, he has a more extreme and more weird energy than anybody else in the room.
You mean like the Andy Hardy movies?
Yeah, even the Andy Hardy movies, which we think of as this wholesome American corn, beloved by Louis B. Mayer, and they are, but within them, Mickey Rooney is bouncing off the walls. I direct you to a Paramount release from the early 30s, the Paramount Pictures version of A Midsummer Night's Dream, with a very, very young Olivia de Havilland, Jimmy Cagney as Bottom with the donkey's head, and Mickey Rooney as Puck, and he must have been about 11 years old, 10 years old, and he is the most baroque gonzo Puck you will ever see. He has an energy that's just when he lets it out is really remarkable to see.
You know, you write about how stardom changed through the decades. And when you get to the 80s and 90s, you talk about how it was the agents that really drove the movie deals. What did that mean in terms of stardom and the value of stardom?
Well, what happens, in the 50s and 60s and 70s is that the movie studios themselves start dying off and other aspects of the industry rush to take their place. And in the 80s and 90s, you did get the rise of powerful agencies, CAA, ICM, William Morris. They didn't make the movies. They didn't produce them. The studios still did that. But they packaged them and they enabled them and they made them possible. And they would go to a studio and say, look, I got Dustin Hoffman and Tom Cruise and a script and a director and they're all our clients, but here you are. It's a package. And yeah, if you end up with Rain Man, great. It's a good movie. More often than not, you ended up with a movie where the parts didn't really make sense, but because all the people in it were clients of a particular agency, that's the deal that got done. And my feeling about a lot of the movies of the 80s and early 90s was that they're deal movies where the work of art that everybody was concentrating was getting the deal done. And after that, the movie itself was sort of secondary.
How do you think stardom has changed from like the days of the movie studios kind of manufacturing the image of the stars to now when it seems to me fewer people go to the movies? Literally to the movie theaters. You know, a lot of people watch movies at home, whether it's on their computer screen or, a small television or a really large screen. I'm sure a lot of people are watching on their, iPads and other devices, which is an even smaller screen than their computer screen. And so the sense of, larger than life and these people living in these like movie palaces, that's really kind of long gone. Because even most movie screens, if you go to the movie theaters, a lot of the movie theaters I go to, the screens really aren't very large anymore.
Right. Movie stars, as we understand them, the classic movie stars are in a way on the wane. I don't think the mainstream film industry, the mainstream American film industry sells us stars the way they used to. And they don't sell movies with stars. They sell movies based on franchises, popular book franchises like Twilight and Harry Potter, on special effects, on comic book heroes. Those are what audiences pay to see. They don't necessarily go to see it because Tom Cruise is in it or because Ryan Gosling is in it. I think there are stars who still have drawing power. I think Will Smith can still bring people to a movie, maybe not as reliably as he did 10 years ago. But I think the whole culture has changed in the sense that we almost don't need classic movie stars the way we used to because the internet allows us to become, to manufacture our own personas in many, many different ways. We can be a different person on Twitter, on our Facebook page, in Second Life, on, you know, our Pinterest page. We can manufacture as many personas for ourselves as we want, which we used to really need movie stars to do. I mean, back in the classic days, audiences, women would go to see Bette Davis movies to see what Bette Davis was going to get away with this time and sort of see what maybe envelopes they could push in their own behavior. We don't need to do that anymore. We can sort of play around with that ourselves. So what happens to the classic movie star in this scenario? They become lesser in value and they become mocked. You know, the famous Tom Cruise Oprah couch scene is still playing at a YouTube channel near you. I mean, it will be there forever. 20 years ago, it would have been fodder for a week of late-night jokes and forgotten. But now it's proof that we have a certain power over these people that used to have power over us.
So something that confuses me about celebrity, you know, when I go to the supermarket and I'm seeing the tabloids at the checkout line, like Jennifer Aniston is still on the cover so much of the time. And like, I have to say, I can't comprehend why. It's not like how many years has it been since Friends and how often is she in a hit movie? What is that fame? What is that interest still based on?
Don't you understand? That's her movie now. That's where her narrative is. It almost helps to think of each star as a narrative, as an idea, and their movies are, and their other entertainment is where they act that idea of who they are out. And we, you know, Jennifer Aniston built up a persona, consciously or not, and on Friends, and then after Friends in the gossip sphere with her various melodramas. And again, this has nothing to do with who Jennifer Aniston may actually be, but I'm talking about her public persona. And as she's made fewer and fewer movies, that narrative just hops over to the gossip sphere and the tabloid magazines, and that's where the people who are fans of her or fans of that narrative, that's where they follow that narrative. That's where that show is. That's where the Jennifer Aniston show is now. It's not on TV. It's not on the movie screen. It's over in this other form of entertainment that, again, probably doesn't have a lot to do with actual day-to-day reality.
Ty Burr, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me on.
Ty Burr is a film critic for the Boston Globe and author of Gods Like Us on Movie Stardom and Fame. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer and technical director is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, Heidi Simon, Teresa Madden, and Yue Shaw. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Nell Beschenstein is our associate producer for online media. I'm Terry Gross.